Señoras y señores, continuamos hoy el ciclo que sobre la nueva neurobiología dio comienzo el lunes pasado en esta misma sala con la conferencia del doctor Hübel. Hoy nos honra con su presencia el profesor Guillemin, que va a hacer una conferencia acerca de la hormona del crecimiento y que va a ser presentado por don José Manuel Rodríguez Delgado, director de investigación del Centro Ramón y Cajal de la Seguridad Social. Mis palabras no son sino para felicitarme de la presencia de tan ilustres científicos en la tribuna de la Fundación y para saludarles a todos ustedes y agradecerles la presencia. Sin otras palabras de mi parte, cedo el uso de la palabra al profesor Rodríguez Delgado. Nada más.
Pues buenas tardes a todos. Y el presentar al profesor Roger Guillemin es para mí un gran honor y un motivo de especial satisfacción personal. En parte, nuestros contactos se han desarrollado a mayor profundidad al formar los dos parte de los 14 miembros del grupo Denhauser, que se reúnen durante una semana, una vez al año, en una isla del Caribe, con intensa participación recíproca en el intercambio científico de ideas, de proyectos y de realidades, así como el compartir historias, experiencias y vidas personales. En estas reuniones en el Caribe he aprendido a admirar su genio científico y afortunadamente también he empezado a conocer el aspecto humano, cálido, artístico, universalista, que es uno de los atractivos, en mi opinión, más sobresalientes del profesor Guillemin. Con tener su obra la máxima calidad y mérito científico, yo me atrevería a decir que quizás sea aún más importante la inspiración de su espíritu cálido, abierto, ansiosa de saber, de arte, de música, de literatura, capaz de querer y de ser querido. Guillemin no es un científico encerrado en Torre de Marfil, sino una persona de tradición francesa y raigambre norteamericana, abierto a la colaboración con diversos países del mundo, motor y fermento de estudiantes, colaboradores y de hombres de ciencia del mundo entero. Quizás en paralelo con su productividad científica y su atractiva personalidad está el hecho de que su obra tiene enorme importancia básica y una gran trascendencia práctica en la práctica de la medicina clínica. El profesor Guillemin nació en Dijon, Francia, en 1924. Su juventud tuvo el sombrío escenario de Francia en guerra, de la ocupación nazi, de los años difíciles de una facultad de medicina sin laboratorios experimentales y de iniciarse en la práctica de una medicina un tanto primitiva. Guillemin fue médico. Médico práctico. Su suerte fue la inspiración de unas conferencias de Hans Selye, que le invitó a trabajar en el Instituto recién creado en Montreal con una modesta beca de estudios y la participación en un programa de endocrinología experimental que le llevó a obtener, después del grado de médico, su grado de doctor en fisiología en 1953. En este año, el joven Guillemin, 29 años de edad, es profesor asistente de fisiología de la Baylor University en Houston, Texas, donde continúa durante 18 años hasta 1970, con el interludio en 1960 de una vuelta a Francia bajo la promesa de una posición académica que no llegó a materializarse. Esto suena también a problemas hispánicos. Ya en 1970 se inicia su etapa en La Joya, en el Salk Institute, con su laboratorio de neuroendocrinología, en el que continúa hasta la actualidad. En 1977, el profesor Guillemin recibe el premio Nobel y en el mismo año obtiene la Medalla Nacional al Mérito Científico presentada por el presidente de los Estados Unidos. El número de medallas, honores, condecoraciones es enorme y no voy a mencionarlo aquí. Su labor científica, que él va a presentar en parte, ha culminado en varios descubrimientos de importancia trascendental en un brevísimo resumen, podríamos decir, número uno, el aislamiento y caracterización de las hormonas hipofisarias que controlan el lóbulo de la hipófisis. Número dos, la síntesis y el estudio de los análogos hormonales del hipotálamo que pueden controlar la fertilidad. Número tres, el aislamiento de la hormona al péptido hipotalámico llamado somatostatina, que tiene gran interés en los enfermos diabéticos. Número cuatro, el aislamiento y la síntesis de otros péptidos hipotalámicos, de las endorfinas, que actúan de manera parecida a los opiáceos. Estas sustancias parecen ser un nuevo tipo de transmisor cerebral y pueden estar relacionadas con las enfermedades mentales, teniendo además unos poderosísimos efectos analgésicos en los seres humanos. Número 5, muy recientemente, en el 1982, descubrió un nuevo péptido llamado somatocrinina que estimula la secreción del factor de crecimiento por la hipófisis, teniendo gran actividad en sujetos humanos y está siendo utilizada para el diagnóstico de diversas enfermedades y tumores de la hipófisis. Hoy creo que nos va a presentar las primicias de sus estudios más recientes. Todas estas investigaciones revelan su mente privilegiada, un enorme esfuerzo personal y una poderosa capacidad de dirección. En su discurso Nobel, el profesor Guillemin comentaba que sus descubrimientos son el resultado del esfuerzo conjunto de más de 100 colaboradores agrupados en Houston, en París y en La Joya, que son los que dan la promesa de un futuro aún más brillante en el fértil campo de las investigaciones hipotalámicas. Hay que recordar que el hipotálamo, junto con la hipófisis, encierra el control maestro del sistema hormonal, además de tener funciones vegetativas y psíquicas de gran importancia. Las investigaciones del profesor Guillemin y su grupo tienen esta doble vertiente del interés científico básico y de la aplicación clínica que ya ha beneficiado a multitud de enfermos. Uno de los aspectos más positivos es la posibilidad de paliar el dolor, evitando el sufrimiento innecesario de muchísimos seres humanos. Siendo enormes las realidades alcanzadas, yo creo que las posibilidades científicas del futuro son todavía mayores. Guillemin tiene esta maravillosa realidad de la labor realizada y la promesa de la labor todavía por realizar. El profesor Guillemin ha compartido sus actividades con una gran persona, su esposa Lucien, y su obra común ha sido los 6 brillantes hijos, cada uno desarrollando talentos distintos. Su casa en La Joya, de estilo mediterráneo, está llena de cuadros de pintores contemporáneos franceses y americanos, de esculturas y cerámicas de la época mexicana precolombina, así como de Nueva Guinea, además de una serie de instrumentos musicales de Lucien, que es una autoridad en piano y en harpsicordio. La fecunda vida científica, intelectual y humanística del profesor Guillemin me recuerda una anécdota vivida con el profesor Fleming aquí en Madrid. Se acababa de descubrir la penicilina, yo acababa de terminar mi carrera y quizás, porque sabía un poquito de inglés, me dieron el encargo de acompañar al profesor Fleming en sus visitas a Madrid. Y recuerdo con emoción el ver a personas que se acercaban a descubrir al gran Fleming, que le besaban las manos, aquellas manos que habían salvado la vida de mi hermano, de mi mujer, de mi hijo. Fleming, y esto es lo que yo creo que en parte se puede aplicar a Guillemin, recuerdo que mirándome y ante mi admiración por este entusiasmo del público que le rodeaba, me dice: mira, Delgado, la fama, el dinero, incluso el mismo premio Nobel, esto no es nada comparado con esta inmensa satisfacción que siento de ver, de sentir que mi vida ha sido útil para tantos seres humanos, que mi esfuerzo ha salvado vidas y ha evitado tanto dolor. De una manera parecida, yo creo que el profesor Guillemin tiene que sentir de esta manera. Su labor ha sido brillante y magnífica, pero quizás lo mejor de todo es esa satisfacción de su obra, aliviando el dolor, y de la promesa de tantos seres humanos beneficiados por sus descubrimientos. Quizá por ello, en su discurso Nobel, Guillamin hablaba de su hogar, como son palabras de él, como el entorno gozoso de una casa feliz. ¡Qué bonito! Por ello, espero y deseo que Roger pueda compartir con nosotros no solamente su ciencia, sino también parte de esta felicidad y de esta personalidad tan magnífica de esta escuela que él ha sabido crear y potenciar. El profesor Guillamin.
Thank you very much, Professor Delgado, for a very gracious introduction. I think that the message to remember from your kind words of introduction for the younger people in this audience is essentially that the difficulties of the younger years are no problem, no impediment to what can happen or follow in the later years in one's life as a scientist. I'm very sorry that I will not be able to give this talk in Castellano. I regret that very much, for many reasons. The first one being that I can read Spanish, I can understand Spanish very well, fairly well, but unfortunately, I'm totally unable to speak in Castellano, with the exception of a couple of words. For instance, if I may have the first slide. El naranjo de tu patio, cuando te acercas a él, se desprende de sus flores y te las echas a los pies. A little copla like this, obviously, to be written, to be pronounced, to be sung, to be danced, requires the function of our brain. Obviously, a copla like this is written, is said, is sung, is danced, only at one time of one's life, when one is old enough to love a young woman. What is far less understood, or far less recognized, is that the brain is also necessary for the normal growth of the organism to reach that stage, first of all, to control the functions leading to puberty, and later, or concomitantly actually, to lead to the functions that produce the harmonious development of the organism. Functions of a part of the brain called the hypothalamus is an absolute requisite for the normal harmonious development, the normal growth, the normal somatic growth of the individuals until the time when he will be happy to sing that little coplita. So we have not only what this simple diagram shows you, that the outside world reaches us through the brain, that the internal environment of our body, what Claude Bernard, the founder of experimental medicine, the founder of modern physiology, called the milieu intérieur, requires the participation of the functions of the brain to establish what we call homeostasis. And this part of the brain that does so is called the hypothalamus, a region, the next slide, a region of the brain at the very bottom part of the brain that you see here, a tiny little part of the brain, and the hypothalamic control of all these functions of the organism takes place by the mediation of another organ, the pituitary gland, which is shown here in this little diagram and expanded up here. The pituitary gland secretes a series of hormones that will control, direct, regulate the function of all endocrine glands of the body, the thyroid gland, the adrenal cortex, the two sex organs, the sex glands, the testes and the ovary, the development of the breast at the time of lactation, And also, we know now the development, the growth of the bones that lead to the somatic growth, and this is what we are going to discuss in more details today. Strangely enough, next slide, the hypothalamus does not control these functions of the pituitary gland by nerves, as you would expect things to take place within the brain. The hypothalamus controls these functions of the pituitary gland through a network of exquisite capillary vessels that bring the blood from the hypothalamus, that would be up here, downhill, downwards to the pituitary gland. Next slide, that you will see here, again with these tiny little capillaries which spread throughout the pituitary gland. It is a very unusual type of nerve-body connection, brain-body connection, which was not recognized for 30 years. It was recognized about the 1950s from the proposal of a British investigator called Geoffrey Harris. But then the question that was asked was, what is the nature of the molecules that go from the hypothalamus to the pituitary through these portal vessels, through these capillary vessels? And this is when I started working on this subject. The next slide. We knew at that time that the molecules involved could not be what we call the classic neurotransmitters, like adrenaline, noradrenaline, serotonin, dopamine, and had to be some new molecules. It took many years, eventually, to establish for the first time in 1969 that the first one of these molecules was what we call a peptide, that is, an assembly of a few amino acids. And the first of the molecules which we characterized, called tyrotropin-releasing factor, which controls the secretion of the thyroid gland, was shown to be a very simple molecule composed of three amino acids. A few years later, we characterized other molecule, one composed of 10 amino acids, which controls in the brain of all of us the functions of the sex glands and the reproduction. We call luteinizing hormone releasing factor. This molecule here is a bigger one, composed of 41 amino acids, and it controls the secretion of ACTH and the activation of the adrenal gland in stress conditions. The last one of the molecules to be characterized, called growth hormone releasing factor, which I also call somatocrinin, was characterized less than 1 year ago. A great deal of what I'm going to tell you in this lecture tonight was not known a year ago. So you are going to be shown this evening, actually, some very recent results from my laboratory and in collaboration with other clinical groups of things which have actually not even been published as yet. Another molecule, which I call somatostatin, was characterized in 1972, while we were already looking for this growth hormone releasing factor. This molecule is an inhibitor of the secretion of growth hormone. We will discuss this at some length later, and some of you, those of you who heard the lecture by Professor Huber last week, will remember that he must have talked to you about this constant balance, these constant feedback mechanisms in one aspect or another of neurophysiology. It is exactly the same sort of things we are dealing with in neuroendocrinology. Next slide. The first observation that showed that the brain was involved in the normal somatic growth was reported in 1959 by an investigator in America called Reichlin, who was able to show that if one places small lesions in the brain of a laboratory rat by stereotaxic placement, one produces this type of obesity, which was very well known and which is actually still not fully explained, but also that one was able to produce a shorter animal, And you see here the femur bone, or the tibia bone of these animals, the control animal, and the animal here with the brain lesion. Obviously, this minute brain lesion had impeded the growth of the animal. Next slide. It was not until many years later that this observation was investigated again, because at that time, when the observation was made in the animal with the lesion in the brain, we had no simple method to assess, to ascertain the secretion of growth hormone. We had only complex and cumbersome bioassays. And it was not until 1963 or so that it was possible to do these sort of studies in a very quantitative manner, when Berson and Yalow invented and reduced to practice this powerful methodology, which is well known to many of you now, called radioimmunoassays, which allows biologists, physicians, to measure infinitesimal amounts of various hormones in body fluids. And this was the first demonstration by the group of Berson and Yalow that if one stimulates the secretion of growth hormone normally, in a normal individual, by lowering blood sugar, by injecting insulin, this is a well-known clinical test, the secretion of growth hormone is now completely inhibited, completely cut down to zero, in a patient in whom the pituitary stalk has been sectioned. You remember the photograph that I showed earlier of the pituitary gland and the stalk containing the small capillary vessels. Several years ago, in patients with terminal cancer, it was a type of surgery that was done in which the section of the pituitary stalk was affected by neurosurgeons. And in these cases, Berson and Yalow were able to show that there was no secretion of growth hormone following hypoglycemia. The next slide. Using the same methods of radioimmunoassays, the same group of investigators was able to show a few years later that in normal individuals, in normal young individuals, the secretion of growth hormone takes place in 3 or 4 episodes during the day. This corresponds, or this follows meals, but the most important secretion of growth hormone takes place at night, during sleep, immediately before the moment we start dreaming. This was a very profoundly important physiological and clinical observation. We must understand that. The secretion of hormones usually is a very steady sort of thing. In the case of growth hormone, it was the first recognition that somehow the brain of normal individuals was involved in controlling the secretion of growth hormone, and it was related with the electroencephalographic recording of the brain waves and could be shown to take place 3 times at night in what we call slow wave sleep periods immediately preceding the dreaming period of REM sleeps. We still did not know what were the exact mechanisms of this secretion of growth hormone at that time. The next slide. But we had, by that time, the various tools available to study the secretion of this growth hormone. And what followed in the following 10 years was what we can call classic neuroendocrinology, in which, according to the classic method described by Claude Bernard, we always come back to this founder of modern physiology, one can produce lesions of an organ. Even in the brain, one can destroy minute parts of the brain, in this case in the hypothalamus, by introducing electrodes and producing lesions by passing with the proper parameters, electric current. So you make lesions of the brain in this part of the hypothalamus, or you make lesions of the fibers of various afferents reaching the hypothalamus. You can also now stimulate these various parts of the brain. Could you perhaps focus this better? I don't think it is properly focused. You can also transplant the pituitary a little. Very good. Perfect. Thank you. You can get the pituitary gland to live in vitro in a series of methods which I described and invented many years ago. Or you can also transplant the pituitary under the kidney capsule, separating it from the brain. And then you can also use bioassays of the blood coming from the pituitary stalk. And eventually, you try to isolate in these extracts, in extracts of the brain, looking for the particular molecule that you are interested in controlling the secretion of growth hormone. Next slide. And eventually, what was proposed, so these are the results of some of these studies. One can stimulate a part of the hypothalamus, as you see here, it means electrical stimulation of this nucleus of the hypothalamus, and you stimulate the secretion of growth hormone in this case. You can also inject a pharmacological agent, in this case, alpha-methyltryptamine, and show that you do not modify the release of growth hormone, whereas if you stimulate in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is one of the afferent to the hypothalamus, the release of growth hormone can be inhibited by treating the animal with this drug called alpha-methyltryptamine. This tells you that the molecule norepinephrine is involved in the control between hippocampus and the ventromedial nucleus of the hypothalamus. All of these are part of the classical studies. Next slide. Leading us to this little diagram in which the physiologist, about 10 years ago, were able to envision the hypothalamic control of growth hormone as follows. The two nuclei important are called arcuate nucleus on each side, and another region here, though less important, called ventromedial nucleus, that somehow these two nuclei, which contain neurons, will send fibers reaching the portal, the capillary vessels going to the pituitary, and secreting at the level of the portal of the capillaries one of these hypothalamic regulatory peptides. Now, that was 10 years ago. Nothing was known at that time of the nature of this molecule. Then I started, next slide, I started to characterize this unknown molecule, which was the growth hormone releasing factor. We did not succeed, but instead we isolated a totally unexpected molecule, which I called somatostatin, meaning an inhibitor of the secretion of somatotropic hormone. This molecule, which was totally unexpected and unsuspected at that time, turned out to be a rather complex polypeptide composed of 14 amino acids, and we were able to synthesize it in my laboratory very rapidly. Next slide. This inhibitor of somatostatin exists in the body in actually several forms, in multiple forms. This, by the way, is another way of writing the structure of these complex molecules in which each amino acid is represented by a single letter, like you have a three-letter code for the genetic code and the writing of nucleic acid. There is a single-letter code to represent the amino acid which compose proteins, and we can, just like writing a sentence, writing the structure of one of these complex molecules. And we know now that the major form of somatostatin is not the 14 residues that we had isolated earlier, but is actually composed of 28 amino acids. This molecule, next slide, which is very active in man also, has been shown to be the hypothalamic mechanism inhibiting the secretion of growth hormone. For instance, if you stimulate the hypothalamus, like I showed earlier, and stimulate the secretion of growth hormone, if you stimulate electrically the hypothalamus, leading to a secretion of growth hormone, if you inject a single injection, a single dose of 10 micrograms of somatostatin to these animals, at the end of the electric stimulation, you completely inhibit the secretion of growth hormone. This was the first, and is to this day, the first molecule characterized in the hypothalamus that is an inhibitor of the secretion of one pituitary hormone. Next slide. Next slide. I then decided about 3 years ago that we should start looking again for the growth hormone activating substance, the growth hormone releasing factor. By that time, we knew a great deal of information about the inhibitory substance, somatostatin. And we knew that in our earlier studies, 15 years ago, if we had failed to characterize the growth hormone releasing peptide, it was because there was so much somatostatin in the extracts of the brain that we could not recognize the activating releasing factor. By that time, we were able to separate somatostatin in three fractions using a method called molecular sieving, in which on top of a column, you apply an extract of the brain and proceed through sieving this molecule, filtrating this extract through the molecular sieve, and eventually you recover in what we call the effluent, a series of localizations for various molecules. So we knew how to recognize the blue, what is shown in blue here, the inhibitory molecule called somatostatin. And that was the first time that we were able to show that indeed in the hypothalamus, between two zones of inhibitory substance was a zone of powerful release of growth hormone. A zone of containing substance which was a powerful releaser of the secretion of growth hormone. Let me tell you that we have been working almost full-time for the last 3 years, trying to isolate, characterize, and establish the molecular structure of that molecule from the hypothalamus of the brain. This was extracts of hypothalamic tissues from pigs. We have also shown the material to exist in the hypothalamus of sheep, of laboratory rats, of monkeys, and also in human brains. It is exactly the same material located in the same place, but we still have not been able to characterize the molecule, establish its molecular structure, and know exactly what we are dealing with. Because this molecule is so potent that in the brain, in each brain of mammalian that we have studied, we know now that there is only 5 femtomoles of that molecule. What is a femtomole? A femtomole is 1/1,000 of a gram. It's 10 to the minus 15. It's an extremely small amount of substance. Then, when the investigator is blocked in studies like this, he has to show some ingenuity. There is a disease called acromegaly. Next slide. Which is well known to physicians, and which is usually due to the development of a tumor of the pituitary gland that secretes large amounts of growth hormone. The disease takes place in adults because if it were to take place in a child, the child would become a giant. It would not become acromegalic. What we call acromegaly is this disease that you see here in which the patients who were adults when the disease started cannot grow over the action of the excess of growth hormone because in adults, our bones have solidified, so to speak, our cartilages do not allow allow any more statural growth. So what happens in these patients when they have a tumor of the pituitary that secretes too much growth hormone? They develop these very peculiar signs of enlarging the nose, protruding the jaw, having these very big fingers. The tongue is also very big. The feet are also very big. And this is a very grotesque and painful disease. And eventually, these people, if they are not operated from the tumor at the base of the brain, will become blind because the tumor will actually destroy the optic chiasm. You see, by the way, in these four pictures, the development, this is a perfectly normal child. Maybe at age 25, she already shows some features of coarseness, and eventually at age 45, she was this patient. In this particular case, this patient had a large pituitary tumor that was removed by the neurosurgeon, and she was cured from her acromegaly. But, next slide, there are some types of acromegaly. There are some very rare cases of acromegaly. Very rare cases. There are about 6 in the whole medical literature that have been described, in which these patients who are the same full-blown acromegalics as I showed you in the preceding picture have no tumor of the pituitary. They have a perfectly normal pituitary, but usually they have a very rare tumor of the pancreas, an islet cell adenoma, an islet cell carcinoma. Sometimes they have a tumor of the lung. The proposal is that in these tumors, in the pancreas or in the lung, these tumoral cells make very large quantities of a molecule that should be identical to the brain peptide, the growth hormone releasing factor, that will stimulate the pituitary to make more growth hormone and eventually produce the acromegaly in these patients, even though they have a normal pituitary. I have been looking for such tumors for many, many years. I repeat, they are exceedingly rare. About a year ago, I was able to obtain 2 such tumors. A small fragment from one of these tumors recognized in the University of Virginia in the United States, and another one recognized by a physician at the University of Lyon in France. We acquired the whole tumor of that patient. That was exactly 1 year ago in the middle of the month of April. The next slide. I sent somebody from my laboratory by airplane to Lyon to at the time of the operation of that patient. We brought the tumor to my laboratory, and in 1 month and 4 days, we were able to finish what we had been trying to do for 12 years unsuccessfully. What we did was to make an extract of that tumor, and you immediately recognize, even though the colors are different, now the somatostatin inhibitor is shown in yellow, but you immediately recognize the large amount of the activating substance in the same location. And by the way, that tumor contained 10,000 times more of the releasing factor on a weight basis than the brain, than the hypothalamus. In 10 days, next slide, we had purified this material into this material, next slide, and this one, next slide, was now isolated into 3 molecules. This method, for those of you who know or recognize it, is called high-pressure liquid chromatography, HPLC. It's a very powerful method, which is used in my laboratory extensively. And in 10 days, we had isolated, actually, 3 molecules with growth hormone-releasing activity. The next slide will show you the complete molecular structure of that molecule. This was characterized in just a few days in the laboratory with a very powerful methodology called gas phase sequenator. I think it can again be better focused. And you recognized a large peptide, thank you. This is a large peptide composed of 44 amino acids. Strangely enough, we can remove all this part of the molecule in red and all the part of the molecule shown in yellow, and we still have biological activity. This, by the way, the white part, the white plus yellow, and the white plus yellow plus red correspond to the 3 molecules which we had isolated in the tumor. This molecule, which was characterized less than 1 year ago, was synthesized in approximately 10 days, also in my laboratory. And next slide, we were able to show in June of last year that the synthetic replicate of that molecule had full biological activity. In other words, we had indeed isolated the growth hormone releasing factor, characterized it, and reproduced it successfully by synthesis. We were able to show that this molecule has what we call homologies with other known hormones. You see here the sequence of the new growth hormone releasing factor, and all I want you to know are these areas marked in yellow, showing the relationships, what we call homology, between that new hormone and other molecules which had been known for many years, which like glucagon, secretin, another molecule called VIP, and all of these molecules are to be found in the gut or in the pancreas. This, by the way, and I will not say any more about this in this lecture, is probably one of the most profound discoveries coming from a great deal of the work in my laboratory over the last 15 years. Namely, the recognition that all these exquisite molecules found in the brain are also found in the gut and in the pancreas, and vice versa, that many of the molecules originally recognized in the gut and the pancreas as being necessary for the function of the gut and the pancreas are also to be found in the brain. The significance of this is still not absolutely obvious, but there is no doubt that we are dealing with the same molecules. The next slide. The next slide will show you the evidence that I mentioned earlier, that the synthetic material which we had reproduced had the full and identical biological activity to the native molecule which we had isolated, either from the tumor or purified from the hypothalamic tissues. The next slide. Next slide again. We also injected this molecule in anesthetized animals and showed that indeed the synthetic replicate stimulated the secretion of growth hormone. Next slide. In vivo, again confirming that we had isolated the right molecule. I would like to show you now, rather rapidly, three slides to show you the problems one can encounter in these studies in physiology and how they can be solved. When we injected this molecule, the synthetic molecule, in normal laboratory rats with no anesthesia, you can prepare such animals with a tube in the vein, you leave them in their cage, they walk around, you can inject them at a distance without their knowing it, you can withdraw some blood using some of the radioimmunoassay measurements to study the secretion of growth hormone. And we observed that we were getting very erratic responses. Sometimes the animals would respond perfectly well, other times not very well, sometimes not at all, and here in a manner that did not follow the date of the injection. We then realized that the inhibitory molecule that I discussed earlier, the somatostatin, was probably involved because it was known that stressing a person, this is true in humans as it is in laboratory animals, stressing an animal will stimulate the secretion of the inhibitor, thus inhibiting the effect of the GRF molecule. Next slide. So what we did was to inject an antibody. You remember last year you had a lecture, you had several lectures on monoclonal antibodies, on the immunological system as a whole. So what we did was to prepare antibodies against somatostatin, and we injected them to a series of laboratory animals, thus inhibiting the action of the endogenous inhibitor, somatostatin, and then we inject the GRF molecule. And what happens, as you see, is that now the animals respond immediately and regularly each time. But we also notice, you also can notice, that the response is not constant. Why is this one is small, this one is medium, this one is very big? We then realized that in the laboratory animals, next slide, we were dealing with the same problem that I showed you in one of the early slides about the release of growth hormone during sleep in a periodic pulsatile manner. What we then had to do was to inhibit in some way the endogenous release of growth hormone in these animals. Here again, we resorted to immunology. And in this case, we designed monoclonal antibodies against hypothalamic growth hormone of the rat. And if we inject these monoclonal antibodies, you see the normal spontaneous secretion of growth hormone in normal animals. And if we inject the monoclonal antibodies in various quantities, eventually, we completely inhibit the secretion of growth hormone in these animals. So, next slide. If we now prepare our animals by injecting, this is such an elegant method, if we inject them simultaneously, the antibody against the inhibitor, somatostatin, and the monoclonal antibody against its own releaser, you now have an animal which is completely free of interfering control for the secretion of its growth hormone. And if you now inject our molecule GRF 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, you always get a response, you always get the same response. And next slide, we can even show, which is very difficult in vivo, to show that we can graduate the response as a function, we can calibrate the response as a function of the dose of the peptide. So this was the ultimate demonstration that the molecule which we had isolated from that tumor was indeed the real molecule from the hypothalamus. But since we had isolated that molecule from a tumor of the pancreas, how were we sure that the same molecule was in the hypothalamus? Next slide. Next slide will show you something which I've never shown anywhere. It is the demonstration, the first demonstration, of the presence of neurons of the human brain containing the molecule GRF. This is, again, a method that you must have heard a great deal in your series of lectures at the Fondation last year in immunology, which we call immunocytochemistry. These cells, these neurons in the human hypothalamus, show the presence of the molecule GRF by reacting them with an antibody against GRF that has been coupled to a fluorescent molecule, which is called fluorescein. And this is the evidence that these neurons, you can see the neurons themselves, you can see the nerve fibers, eventually are present in the hypothalamus. And all these fibers in the human hypothalamus, you see more here, more here, more here, eventually, next slide, will coalesce into vessels, into bundles, and reach the vessels around the capillaries. This is a diagram of the hypothalamus with the two nuclei that we had discussed earlier from the electrophysiology, the arcuate nucleus of the infundibulum, the ventromedial nucleus. They send their fibers around the small capillary vessels of which I'd shown you the two photographs in the early part of the lecture. And eventually, this molecule reaches the pituitary and stimulates the secretion of growth hormone. The next slide is a summary of this whole lecture, which we can show in such simple graphic way. Everything I've told you so far is in that simple diagram. This little diagram represents a cell of the pituitary gland making growth hormone. These are the cells of which we have about 5 million in our pituitary that make growth hormone and release it at the time of sleep and immediately following meals. They do so being stimulated, green, by growth hormone releasing factor. GRF stimulates the secretion of growth hormone. There is also the possibility of an inhibitor, somatostatin, coming from the brain to inhibit this action. But there is far more. We know now that growth hormone stimulates in various tissues molecules which we call somatomedins. For those of you who know this field as endocrinologists, these molecules, somatomedins, are also called IGF, insulin growth factor, insulin-like growth factor. And I have recently demonstrated, just a couple of months ago, that these molecules are also able to produce an inhibitory red is inhibitory, is stop, an inhibitory feedback at the level of the pituitary cell. So once more, exactly as you heard in Huber's lecture the other day, when you had a series of constant feedbacks for the visual cortex, in the visual cortex, for the perception of a given pattern. In endocrinology, in neuroendocrinology, we have this very same concept of constant negative feedback here, or active inhibition from an activator. This is typical of the physiological control of physiological functions. This is very different from the type of redundancy of the engineers. This is the type of redundancy for the inhibitions of physiology, where multiple systems can actually modulate. This is the key word. You have a series of systems, activators, inhibitors, modulating eventually the secretion of growth hormone to keep this remarkable homeostasis as described by Claude Bernard 100 years ago. In closing, I will show you rapidly three or four slides of a series of studies which have never been shown anywhere. None of this has been published because these data have been obtained over the last 3 months. Next slide. With availability of large quantities of the synthetic replicate of our GRF made in my laboratory at the Salk Institute, after obtaining the necessary clearances from the Food and Drug Administration in Washington, the FDA in Washington, we have supplied this material to four clinical centers for clinical studies. One group in San Francisco, my colleagues at the University of California in San Francisco, the group of Lyon, who had recognized originally the tumor of that patient, a group in Tokyo of one of my former collaborators, and a group of my local collaborator in San Diego. Altogether, the last count, a couple of days ago, was that more than 200 people had actually been involved in these studies. And the results are remarkable. To show you the universe, and one of the reasons why, by the way, I decided to participate in the clinical studies in four different centers all over the world, was essentially to ascertain the universality of the observation. Something which is real should be as good in Madrid as it is in Tokyo or in Paris or somewhere else. And this is exactly what we see. The next slide will show you some results that were obtained from the group in Tokyo, where a series of subjects were given small quantities from 50 micrograms to 200 micrograms in a single intravenous injection of the synthetic molecule. And as you see, they immediately release their growth hormone from the baseline almost zero to 30 to 35 nanograms of growth hormone per ml, which is a very large response. The next slide will show you a similar response now obtained by the group in Lyon at the medical school, Alexis Carrel in Lyon, where the normal subjects were injected with four different doses, from 75 micrograms to 600 micrograms of the peptide. And you see again that there is a dramatic response of all of these patients, these subjects. This represents about 40 individuals. The next slide will show you again some studies, some clinical studies, where now multiple doses were obtained. I beg your pardon. This last slide is the evidence of the clinical use of this material. This is the first report of a case of a child with dwarfism, with arrest of growth due to a peculiar syndrome which is well known to those of you who may be pediatricians, but which I don't want to discuss as such. And these children, if you leave them by themselves, will remain absolute dwarfs. Their pituitary gland does not secrete growth hormone. You may remember the slide in which I discussed the release of growth hormone in the patient with the pituitary stoke that was produced by hypoglycemia, by injecting insulin. In this child, when you do this test, there is no release of growth hormone. Growth hormone remains absolutely flat. There are other such tests, what we call the glucagon propanolol test. In this child, there was no response whatsoever. Growth hormone would remain just like this. The only molecule that was shown to stimulate the growth hormone in that child was injection of GRF, as was reported by the group in Lyon, again the group of clinician colleagues who recognized the tumor of that child, of that patient last year. So you see, I'm very happy to have been able to show you tonight what is indeed the complete progression, and I'm saying this essentially for the younger people in the audience, the younger students who may be interested in medical research. What you have seen in this lecture is the complete circle from the idea, the beginning of an idea. The hypothalamus of the brain may be involved, must be involved, is involved in the control of the secretion of growth hormone. What does it? We characterize the molecule that does it. We reproduce that molecule. We show that that molecule indeed secretes, stimulates the secretion of growth hormone, and ultimately, you see now the clinical application of these observations. Now, in case you think, which I hope you have not, that I have done all of this by myself, you are obviously mistaken. The next slide will show you a series, a photograph of my senior collaborators in all these studies, a group of wonderful young people, Paul Brazo, who does all the bioassays that we discussed here, Fred Esch, who did the sequence of the molecule, Fusun, who is doing the tissue cultures and who actually went to collect this tumor, as recognized by this lady here, the French physician, the medical school in Lyon, Dr. Bolan, who actually established the whole process of isolation of the hormone in 1 week, Dr. Ling, who synthesized this molecule, and Dr. Werenberg, who actually did the studies in the rat with the antibodies that I showed you. Now, to do science, you need ideas, a budget, collaborators, and also a laboratory. And the last slide will show you a building which I consider to be a very beautiful building, in which the laboratory is at the Salk Institute. And I'd like to reciprocate, so to speak, the invitation of the Fondation Rond March to come to this elegant building to deliver this lecture by asking or offering all of you hospitality when you come to visit us in California and see these laboratories. Thank you.